Good afternoon and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Grief is a normal reaction to the loss of a relative or a close friend. We all grieve, but children grieve differently than adults. One reason that this happens is that children have a variable understanding of how and when death develops and what it means. Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Outside Anchorage, call toll-free at 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is line1@aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll talk about grieving and children on Line One, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is helping children learn and experience the grief process. Our phone numbers are familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, and our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255. You can also email us at line1@aprn.org. My guests today are Karen Moyer of the Moyer Foundation and Camp Aaron, and Donna Stevens and Shirley Wilson of the Hospice of Anchorage. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Welcome to all of you. Before we get started, I'm going to make just a brief comment. I want to remind our listeners that if you have kidney disease, that this Saturday, October 3rd from 9 to 2 at the Anchorage Baptist Temple, there will be a kidney screening if you have risk of kidney disease such as high blood pressure or diabetes. You can reach them at 223-1562, 223-1562. And the other thing I want to comment on is this issue of we're going to be hearing so much about it, and this is influenza, and I was caught by a New York Times story this morning reminding people that just because you get a shot and something happens nearby after that shot, it's not necessarily due to the shot, and this has been a problem that the federal officials are trying to get a head start on, and you need to remember that lots of things happen in close contact. I may have gotten in the car and drove here this morning and had a hat on. It doesn't mean that having a hat on all the time means I have to be in a car. There's lots of things that happen coincidentally and have nothing to do with cause and effect. And if someone were to get an influenza shot and maybe have a miscarriage, you have to remember that there's hundreds of thousands of miscarriages every year. And with that many miscarriages, oftentimes other things will happen close by. To figure out whether there's true cause and effect, you have to look at the background rate of a problem before, say, the vaccine is given. And then also you have to look at how much of that same problem may be happening in unvaccinated populations. The government is doing that. They're looking very hard for it. At this point, it's very, very clear that it's very unusual to have severe reactions. It's estimated that maybe one or two per million will have some significant untoward effect. Most of us will have very minor effects. On the other side of the coin, what's the risk if you get influenza? Well, there's about 35,000 excess hospitalizations and 250,000 extra hospitalizations associated with the vaccine. So for most of us, it's going to make sense to try to get ourselves protected and also to protect those who may not be able to get the vaccine for one reason or other that are also at risk. Karen, you're on the telephone joining us from I don't know where, Seattle, I'm guessing, but maybe that's not true.
Well, actually, I'm up in Canada. Ah. I flew there from Florida. That's where we're actually living during the academic year in Florida, and I'm part of a very cool thing up in Canada with a fantastic organization called Free the Children, and they have helped in many different countries, and they're about motivating children to be the change, and so they're having a huge rally. And I have 8 children, of which I've brought my older 4, to hear these motivational speakers and to actually get to meet some of them, one of which is the Dalai Lama. So we are feeling very lucky today. Yeah.
Well, tell us, you and your husband apparently have co-founded or did co-found the Moyer Foundation. I'd like to know a little bit about that. And then while you're doing that, why don't you tell us how that evolved into Camp Aaron and what that's
sure.
all about.
I'll be brief because it's about as long as my husband's career and probably before that, that I've been giving back. And obviously, if I'm doing something like this right now in Canada, I'm conscious of raising my children to be socially responsible. So when I met my husband, I was working in television, and that really wasn't working as he moved from team to team to team. And so I found philanthropy to be my passion and purpose. And we created the Moyer Foundation in Seattle, Washington 10 years ago, purely with the mission of wanting to help children in distress. And so that's pretty broad. And through those experiences, we meet children, obviously, and we met this young woman, Erin Metcalf, at her age of 15, and she had cancer that she couldn't fight till the age of 17. And when she was passing, she was very concerned about what was going to happen to her sisters. And my husband and I were very aware of a grief camp in Indiana where I had grown up that we had helped fund. And in the back of our mind, it was there. And then when we heard Erin's wishes, we thought, well, maybe we could bring that camp to the Northwest. And so that's exactly what we've done. At least 7 years ago now, Camp Erin has existed in the Northwest, and it's expanded even internationally. We have 28 of them, including Toronto.
Hmm. We should maybe mention your husband is Jamie Moyer. He's still pitching. He was with the Phillies last time.
Still pitching, yeah. He signed a two-year deal, so he is officially the oldest baseball player in the major leagues, left-handed pitcher, and they are in the playoff hunt and should clinch in the next 2 days. So should be another fun offseason for us.
And the connection with the Northwest is he was with Seattle for quite a while.
Yes, he played one of the eight teams that he had a long stint with was the Seattle Mariners. And it was 10-plus years. And that was not home for us. And as we started a foundation with the mission of wanting to help children, they embraced us and our mission, and because of their support and belief in us and what we're doing, we were able to do lots of great things, including Camp Erin.
Mm-hmm. You know, it still begs the question to me that although you all have clearly done some wonderful stuff, how you really got interested, what was the motivation? You obviously like children, having eight of them, and you obviously got involved very early. Was there some attachment with the idea of bereavement that other than Erin, who you met as she was dying, or was that the big motivation there?
I know. Most people ask us all the time, you know, what's the personal connection?
Right.
Other than that, my grandfather, when he passed, you know, nearly 16 years ago, and hospice being around at that moment, and that was the first real close-to-death experience, you know, that I had had personally, and we were there with him when he passed, they were so comforting. And so from there, Jamie and I decided to look into hospice and what they do for children, just because we just wanted to make that part of our mission as children, and found this grief camp in Indiana, like I mentioned, where I grew up. So what a great concept, where these kids come together on a Friday, complete strangers, and their tragedy can be so different. Their economic background, their, you know, ethnic background, but these kids come together on a Friday evening, not knowing each other, sharing their experiences. You know, this little boy's dad was murdered. This little girl's mom lost her life to illness or disease. This little girl had her brother drowned at a young age. All the same common tragedy is that they've lost someone that they love. And none of us can ever understand that until we're around it and have experienced it. So friends at school aren't going to say the right things, you know, even family. And so when they're around other kids just like them, they're empowered, they're strengthened, and they go through all these great grief experiences that help them, strengthen them, and empower them to go home better people and able to deal.
Donna, Camp Erin had its first Anchorage or Alaska experience, and my understanding is it's just completed. You want to tell us a little bit about how it went?
Yes. Well, we are... had our wonderful weekend started just this last Friday night. We were up at Camp Carlquist at Mirror Lake with 46 children and teens, and we completed Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. And as Karen has said, that children came with each their unique story, and many of them feeling alone and a couple of them with tears when their parents left. But there were many tears on Sunday afternoon when they left their new friends and facilitators.
Yeah, they came in crying and left crying. But during the camp, there was lots of laughter in between.
Give us some idea of what happens at camp. I mean, it's a camp experience, but I get the feeling there's a there's an educational component, if that's the right term.
Right. Well, one of the things that we know is that kids grieve a little bit differently than adults, and they tend to do it in what I call spurts and bursts. I've heard it referred to as looking like a ping pong ball. So they they need to play. They can't cope with all the reactions of grief in a continuous basis. So they play, they laugh, they tease, they're angry, whatever kids might do, then they grieve, then they go back to playing. And so at camp, we did the same kind of thing. We had some grief-related activities, but they were interspersed between lots of fun.
Mm-hmm. What's the age, and then how's it paid for?
The youngest child is six with the Camp Aaron model, and our oldest are 17. And the Camp Aaron, there's no charge for the participant at camp. So we're very fortunate to have our major sponsor, the Moyer Foundation, to help with the camp, and then funding from companies and individuals that helped us support here in Anchorage this first year. New York Life was a big participant. We had some of their people were actually volunteer mm-hmm. camp and big buddies. They helped to pay for our T-shirts. Each child received a teddy bear. And New York Life agents paid for the teddy bear for each child.
Karen, tell us a little bit about the national aspects of the camp. You'd mentioned there's quite a few. What's the goal, and where are they right now?
Well, we, like I said, started them in the Northwest and grew them a little bit down the West Coast and had decided that, you know, to leave this legacy behind and really plant them across America, what would be a good plan? We thought leaving them in every Major League Baseball city would be a good plan. So that's our goal, and next year is phase three of that. So we will have them in all the baseball cities, plus others like Alaska we've added. So we always add other cities as well. And so by 2012, we will have 60 camps across North America.
What has been your experience with the camps? What have you learned? What have you taken away that's one of the biggest, maybe unexpected benefits of camp?
I've been able to attend camps throughout the years, and it's definitely on my top five list of favorite things to do, truly. And there's lots of reasons for that. These children fill my heart personally. I have always been able to relate to children, and I can get to their level and ask them their story and have true compassion for the sadness, and also express that, you know, your mommy or daddy must be really proud of you for, you know, moving on, and it's okay to cry, and just reassure them through their feelings. And then to witness, all of us should witness, when they show up on Friday as strangers from all backgrounds, like I mentioned, and they're comforting each other, it is such a beautiful scene. We should all take note and, you know, be that way with everyone. And because we're all human beings and we're all going through different things, and when it's brought to that level and they're comforting each other, it's like, wow, you know, let's step back and learn from that. And then just to witness, they don't even realize throughout the weekend the little things that they're going through that are helping heal them, and they are literally healing through their tears, and it gives them hope. And that's what it's about. And statistics show if we don't deal with grief, these children have problems later. They mm-hmm. can have serious problems.
Right.
You know, most of the guys on death row lost a parent before they were 18. If 1 in 20 are losing a parent by the age of 18, we've got to deal with it. They'll have relationship issues, you know, that can lead to drugs and alcohol, other behavioral things. So it's really, really important. It's something we don't think about. And when you're going through it as a parent, let's say you lose your spouse, you know, it is so difficult. And you want to think that everybody's doing okay and everybody's, you know, the kids are protecting the parents. And, you know, it's just, you have to deal with it. And everybody's different. It deals with it in different ways. But, you know, most people, you'd be surprised, are touched and have lost a loved one at a young age.
You know, I would also hazard a guess that there's a lot of benefit from getting individuals together who have a similar problem. They no longer feel that isolation, that I'm the only one that's experiencing this, and that there's some group psychology that is beneficial. Has that been an experience that anyone notices at these kinds of camps?
Absolutely. I think that's it, hands down, is this the empowerment of being around others just like you. You're sad, or you feel that way, or you've experienced that, and you're doing okay. Or let's say the counselors. Mm-hmm. Many of them at the camps have lost a loved one, mm-hmm. or wished that they had had the camp when they were younger, and they express that. It's very open, and mm-hmm. we have many counselors that wish that they, you know, had this camp for the same reasons and say they get as much out of the camp as the kids. The big buddies, they are wonderful role models and really break the ice and make these kids have fun. And I've witnessed, because a lot of the kids' counselors that they have throughout the year volunteer at the camps. So I've witnessed through them telling me, you know, all this year that I've known that child, I've never seen them laugh or smile. And that's all they've been doing.
We had two little girls at registration as they came to camp that were about 7 who had been to Camp Toga Woods, our Girl Scout camp, mm-hmm. and had met each other there. And when they first saw each other at camp, their arms just flew around each other, and they were saying, "I didn't know you had someone that died too."
Wow.
So surely it's almost therapeutic just getting people together that have similar issues. And it doesn't have to be bereavement. It could be cancer. It could be asthma, for example.
Because so many of the reactions to grief are normal. Uh-huh. So the idea is how to facilitate it. And if you don't have people around you that you can relate to in relation to that particular experience, it tends to become a secret. And with children, so much of their grieving is done through play and activity and in relationship that children will do what they think their parent needs them to do. And when they get around other children who are in a similar situation, then they're free. They don't have to have a secret, and they can play out what it is that they need to play out and be who they are without holding a secret or without attempting to protect their parents or do what their parents need. And it's interesting because parents also want to protect their children. So you have the children protecting the parents and the parents protecting the children. And getting together with people that are similar to you in height and age and interest and development, where the brain is in development, it makes a huge difference.
Karen, I know you have some other activities you need to go to, and I'd like to go ahead and maybe talk some more, and then we'll come back to the clinical aspects after you have to leave. Tell us a little bit more about the activities of the Moyer Foundation. It sounds like an exciting place to be.
Well, you know it is. I think that through the Moyer Foundation, it's a place where we try to build a big team. Obviously, the bigger the team, the bigger the difference you're going to make. And we really believe that everyone has time, talent, and or treasure to share with those, as well as realizing that it's our social responsibility to give back and make it a better world. So when you have a broad mission for children in distress, you can help, you know, all different kinds, whether it's emotional, physical, financial. And we've created other things such as Camp Mariposa, another camp, which helps children who are affected by addiction. So if they've got a parent or sibling in the home who's an addict, they can attend this camp 5 times throughout the year. And so, again, it goes back to being empowered because you're with kids oh, your mom does that with crack, so is my mom, you know, or, oh, you feel this way when, you know, you have invisible friends, like I do when, you know, you feel alone, and just those, you know, I mean, those are real issues that kids have, and, you know, it is our responsibility to be helping them with this. This is for age groups 9 to 12, and that is an age group that has not been taken care of. We have stuff for youngers, and then we had stuff for teens, but not this in particular age. So that's going on 2 years old, and that's really exciting to follow. In fact, the National Drug Association is following that, too. So hopefully that can turn into some state funding. The other thing that we're really proud of at the Moyer Foundation is that we, you know, we help grassroots organizations in the Northwest, of which have been over 170 different organizations. And we just believe to, you know, giving back to the little ones that a lot of times are forgotten. And this economy, you know, that's, it's something that's really forgotten, where a lot of these little ones are having to collaborate together just to continue with their mission and what they're doing to help others. So grassroots organizations, we do a lot for the Fred Hutch Cancer Research Center for early detection and cancer research. And then we also help with our local children's hospital and the palliative care program. And so the great thing is that any child could walk in, or we could learn about something, and because our mission is so broad, we can help these children. So no matter the distress, we're there, and we're making a difference, and we'll continue to do that for a really long time. You know, obviously Camp Erin is something that we're really, really proud of. It's great for a professional athlete that who's had a really long career, nearly 20, gosh, he'll be starting his 24th year next year, and has played all over, to be leaving behind these camps. But what they are seeds, like we did in Alaska. And so, you know, great organizations take this camp, the model, and they run it, and they're the superstars. And we just, you know, fund it and keep it going, and hope that it can grow through more funding and help more children, because there are waiting lists. And so, you know, for us to be able to use our celebrity status, so to speak, make teams in each of these communities where the communities are embracing it, you know, that's something that's great to be a part of, and, you know, hopefully it'll continue to grow.
You know, I have an opportunity over the 10 years I've been doing this program to interview lots of people, and one of my most favorite people was a physician at the University of Washington named Steve Baruchka. He's an ER physician, but he's also very involved in looking at what makes populations of individuals healthy, and that is different than health care. You can spend a lot of money on health care, as we're demonstrating in this country, and not necessarily get good population health. And what strikes me about what you're doing is one of the things they find is that social networks are really what makes the difference in countries, that the overall population is healthy. It's not how much you're spending on health care, but these social networks. So I don't know if that fits with what you're doing, or I'm getting way out of line, but it's the first thought that comes to my mind is that is something that, as much as we spend on health care in this country, we are not really good at maybe these social networks, and we need to be better at it.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that, you know, sometimes if we think out of the box, or if we even go back to just completely simplifying and trying to remember, and then it takes a network of people. It has to, and everybody has something that they can share. It's a matter of finding your passion and, you know, reaching out and figuring out a way to make a difference, and if we all do that, it is going to be a better world. And so through Camp Erin and other things at the Moyer Foundation, that's happening. And I encourage people to, you know, check out our website. And, you know, we're real big fans of Kids Helping Kids. And that can help in any community, whether it's a lemonade stand or a corn drive at a school. You pick your cause that you're passionate about, and, you know, you teach your kids to be to wanting to be the change and make change.
Tell us before you take off, what can people do who want to be involved to help?
I think checking out our website, that's MoyerFoundation.org, you're going to find out lots of things about what we've got going on, but in particular Camp Erin, because, like I said, 60 of them across the United States and Canada is many. So whether it's in the city that you grew up in, or the city you live in, or you know, the one in Alaska that you can help with. We encourage that for so many reasons, and I promise you there'll be nothing more gratifying to you than to witness the beautiful things that happen at Camp Aaron, all because we did it in memory of a wonderful young teenager who was concerned about her sisters, had the wherewithal to be concerned about her sisters as she was passing, and from that we can help many others.
Karen, thanks for taking the time to be with us today. We're going to continue on line one to talk more about the clinical aspects of this, but best wishes and keep up the good work.
Thank you for what you do, too.
All right.
Many blessings.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Karen.
You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. You can also get us by email at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk with Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Hospice of Anchorage, and Shirley Wilson, a psychiatric nurse practitioner working with the hospice as well. This is Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line One, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, providing Alaska women complete breast imaging services since 1986, including radiologists who specialize in breast imaging 5 days a week. Information online at provimaging.com. And by the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with the wheelchair on the sign.
This is Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about grieving in children. We've recently, in the first half hour, spoken with Karen Moyer for the most part. She's a co-founder with her husband, Jamie Moyer, of the Moyer Foundation, which has established a series of camps called Camp Aaron that has helps children bereave. Now we're going to try to talk a little bit more clinically about children and grieving with Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Hospice of Anchorage, and Shirley Wilson, a nurse, psychiatric nurse practitioner there in the studio with me. If you've got questions or comments about what you're hearing today, you can reach us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255, and you can email us at lineone@aprn.org. Remember, if you're listening tonight between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. It's only until just before 3 that we'll be able to answer your questions directly. Donna and Shirley, let's talk about the grieving process a little bit more fundamentally. Let's assume we're sitting down talking about grieving and I'm a parent. What are the basic fundamental bits of information that are important for most of us to understand about grieving?
That we all do it. Mm-hmm. It's very normal. It's a very human response, and it involves the entire body. So grief reactions are not only emotional, but physical and cognitive. But that physical piece, yeah, Donna.
Social, spiritual. I think that what is so surprising to people about grief is that it is so all-encompassing. Most people expect to be sad and that's what grief's about, but it's so much more than sadness. It's not being able to eat or eating too much, not being able to sleep or sleeping too much, having the same pain in your body that might be related to the way the person died, having asking the big questions, and we even find this in children that I think of as spiritual questions. Why are we here? Why did this happen? Mm-hmm. Why my mom or my dad was a good person? How does this happen? Why does this happen to good people? So many were affected so holistically. by grief.
And initially, it's just such a horrible shock. You know, that's that. It's just no. There's a big no. And people tend to go numb initially. And whatever it is that they do or they're feeling, it's okay. It's okay. It's what they need
to do. So what are the most common feelings? And then I'm going to come back and ask, what are the most common physical symptoms then?
I think the most you want to start with feelings?
Yeah, and let's talk about in general. I know we need to get to kids, and it's maybe different, but what about for adults? So we have some frame of reference to start
well,
with.
Well, you know, some of us are old enough to remember Kubler-Ross when she came out with her stages of grief. We really don't use those very much at all anymore, although you still can find them in textbooks. But that was kind of limiting, but denial, anger, bargaining. We don't find that people really do that. In fact, I think she was working at most with dying, and we took the concept and made it – we want to make it easy. I think we want to make grief easy. We like to put it in a box. We don't want to think about it in our society. We don't do a very good job with it. So we try to put it in a box, and it just doesn't fit there. But common reactions are the sadness, the missing is very common in grief. Often anger at the person of why they died that can be really surprising to people. You know, how can I be angry at my wife because she died of breast cancer? But I'm raising two children by myself, and I'm just so angry with her that she had breast cancer and died. Occasionally we find people that are relieved when somebody dies, and that feels very guilty. How can I be relieved that they've died?
And the sense of feeling crazy and losing your mind and not being able to concentrate or think. So many of the things that you feel, you could label it as depression. It's grief. Grief. All
so
of
those
things.
Are all normal. That's important,
normal.
What we want people to hear. And then you mentioned that it can be physical. You talked about that this is an all-encompassing, both physical and emotional. What about physical kinds of things that people experience?
Headache, backache, stomachache, your throat hurts. You've got a lump in your throat. You've got you feel like you might be having a heart attack. You have palpitations. Oh, gosh, just about any physical symptom that the human body can experience can be experienced in grief. And people do tend to get sick a little bit easier when they're grieving.
Right. The immune system is certainly affected by high stress levels, and grief is high stress. Mm-hmm. And so people tend to get colds, and you know, those little bugs running around just are more, we're more susceptible to them when we're grieving. So I think it's important to realize that, you know, if you're grieving and you're having physical symptoms, you can sort of ask yourself, is this because I'm grieving? And often you'll just know, yes or no, it's not. And even just sometimes asking yourself to sit with this a little bit in the missing and the sadness and my heart's beating fast. And if you just give it a little bit of attention and honor that, it stops. If you're really having a lot of pain and it's not stopping, it's not good to assume it's your grief. You want to go get checked out by your physician if you're having continuing problems. But often when people are grieving, they have those symptoms that come and go.
Being on the other side of this, I think it's very important for people to not be afraid or not be remiss in not communicating with physicians that this is what's going on.
And, absolutely.
The psychological aspects of healthcare are huge, and those of us who have been at it a long time recognize that a high percentage of patients we see with some of these symptoms do not have physical problems and have psychological problems. And it helps for the patient to recognize that and to bring it up during the conversation, because sometimes it's difficult for physicians to get into that and feel comfortable with it. So I want to say it, you know, tell us everything. don't hold it back. Let us know what you think may be going on. It helps us.
You know, because we deal with And help and are supporting grieving children means that we spend a lot of time supporting grieving adults. Somebody's caring for those children, and most often they're grieving also. So at Camp Erin, we spent about 2.5 hours with parents yesterday about how they, as grieving parents and caregivers, can take care of grieving children. But one of the biggest things, I think, for grieving caregivers is taking care of themselves and the stress level, taking care of their body. Sleep is often a difficulty, because of the stress level. And I believe that our grief is really in our neuropathways. And when someone important in our life has died, they're part of all of our neuropathways. And you start down the road like it was, and all of a sudden, intellectually, you realize it's not that way anymore. And the pain of that remembering is overwhelming to the whole system. And the work of grief is figuring out, how do I go on living and loving in a healthy way, even though I have this big hole in my heart that everything has changed. Nothing will ever be the same as it was. And so we have to regrow new neural pathways. People will wake up in the morning, and if, say, it was the husband that died and he always got up and make the coffee, they're sure they smell coffee when they wake up. Mm-hmm. And that's part of our neural pathway system. Mm-hmm. And it takes a while to remember nobody could have made the coffee, and that you actually get out of bed and go check to see if there's coffee brewing because you can smell it. Mm-hmm. And you can't. Mm-hmm. But it's a normal, and that's part of, I think, of what happens with it makes you feel crazy when things like that happen. Mm-hmm. One of our teenagers told a story. She was just so upset that she was walking down downtown, and her dad had died, and she saw her dad walking down the street in front of her. And before she knew what she was doing, she ran and jumped on this man's back. Well, as soon as the man turned his head to find out what was on his back, to find a teenager, she realized it couldn't possibly be her dad and crumpled to the sidewalk in tears and couldn't tell him why she jumped. Her friend came up and didn't know what had happened to her either, but slowly they were able to figure it out. But she was absolutely convinced she was crazy. Mm-hmm. Because she had done this. And so at a grief group with other teens
who have had similar experiences, and they can share that. Mm-hmm.
How did children differ in this experience?
Their brains are in a different place. So if you can somehow remember what it was like to be a child, and if you're an adult, you probably don't remember that very well. So you ask the child, depending on their age, they're in a very magical kind of world. Everything is revolving around the child. Time is different to children. And they tend to react with their entire bodies. And they also tend to be in the moment. So they, at that moment, they'll be feeling or thinking whatever it is that they're feeling or thinking. And then they'll move into the next moment. So they're learning about words and learning about communicating with words. But prior to that, so much of the communication is physical and through symbols, through play, and through relationship. And they're in relationship with their parents. So they know their parents well, and the parents want so much to protect the child at the time of a significant death or loss. And so it's an interesting process.
I always try to think about remembering that children don't have the breadth of experience. They don't know that you go to the hospital, most people come out. They may see mm-hmm. one person go to the hospital and not come out.
Yeah, and generalizing.
And so they have to experience all of these issues, and that's how the adult understanding comes to being, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. With children, when someone's ill and dying, we talk with children. We use very, 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 that they're very, very, very sick.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all get sick,
mm-hmm.
but like you're saying, until you've had the experience that they're very, very, very sick and not even the doctors can help them to get better,
mm-hmm.
Helps the younger they are, the more concrete we have to be in our words. We try to encourage people not to talk about losing a person.
No, why don't you just go find them?
If you say lose,
yeah.
right.
It doesn't make much sense.
Right.
And the children have, up until, I would say, about the age of 6 or 7, they really don't understand the permanency of death. You know, when we tell children that their person has gone to heaven, if that's our belief system, mm-hmm. we might as well have told them they went to New York.
Well, yeah, and when are they coming back?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And children,
because children don't have that breadth of experience. It's a concrete way of thinking, and sometimes
right.
the way that's understood. Somebody's a speaker on the wall is talking. Well, that kid at 4 or 5 may think that wall is talking.
Mm-hmm.
Not
mm-hmm.
that there's somebody talking through an intercom on.
But they will use the mm-hmm. words dying and dead very appropriately
mm-hmm.
from our point of view, the way we use them,
mm-hmm.
but they still don't understand that permanency right. A little girl who was 6 and was her 6th birthday and her dad had been dead for 2 years asked her mom the morning of her birthday, will dad be here?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and developmentally, they will revisit that death at a different place.
Yes.
Let's take a phone call. John, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thanks, Dr. Word. I just wanted to encourage people. You know, I went through this with my sons, and really, you know, I had wonderful support from family and friends. I was lucky enough to have both in the community, but I think just hearing what your guests are saying about just the knowledge that they bring to bear about very specific ways that children grieve is just invaluable. And I wanted to mention that if I had a chance to send them to this camp, you know, right now, you know, I think, oh, a camp and it's in the summer and how's it going to fit in with everything? I'd do it in a heartbeat. You know, if there's any parents out there that are even thinking about that. I have a young relative who's just lost her father in the last month, and she's just slightly too young for this camp, which is too bad. But I wanted to say that there's this amazing resource now available that wasn't available when my kids were going through this at the Susan Butcher Center. And I'm not sure entirely. I think they may have resources available beyond the immediate, cancer victim and their families. But I don't know. your guests may know, or somebody might be able to call in. But it's a tremendous resource. And also I want to say that I did make some use of hospice group counseling at the time, but I think, you know, waited too long and didn't make as much use of it as I would have in retrospect, because I think it's really important that it's not enough to think that you're just, you know, just getting through it. And and I think that if you focus more on what the guests are saying about long term, that's very helpful.
Yeah, it never stops.
John, thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
Sure enough.
Have a good day.
You too.
What about you all? So the camp is here one short period of time. What else is available is what I'm hearing John also say, besides saying, hey, let's take advantage of this.
Right. Well, Hospice of Anchorage has our year-round program called the Forget-Me-Not Grief Program for children and families. And we meet twice a month. And in peer groups, as Shirley has said, when you're with people your same size. So we children come, and we take children at forget-me-not as young as they come. We take infants,
yes.
And we love and sing to them while their parents, if they're wanting to participate in their peer groups. But even babies grieve. They don't grieve, obviously, in words, but they grieve with their – we see the grief in their behaviors. So we take – so that a grieving parent or caregiver can come with the whole family, and the children go to their separate peer groups by age, developmental age. And the parents – there are two groups for adults, adults who have had a child die and adults who have had an adult die, often a spouse – a friend, a parent, sometimes an adult child. They'll choose to go into the adult group.
We only have about 10 minutes. This is really moving fairly fast. I want to remind our listeners, if you have questions or comments and you're not sure whether you really want to get them answered, this is a very, very good time, and we only have about 10 minutes left, 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and you can reach us at line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. I also are often like to ask about misconceptions and myths. Is this a reasonable thing to ask you all? Are there common misconceptions and myths you'd like to have cleared up about grief and grieving?
Sure.
Can you remember them?
Can we remember
a list of them?
There is a whole list of myths.
Yeah, I think probably the first one is that children get over it really fast, and that if they're not showing it, that they're not grieving. Mm. But any loss, a child will grieve it. Mm-hmm. What's another myth?
Time heals all.
Oh, time heals all. And time does make a difference, but it doesn't heal all. You need to do the work. You've got to feel the feelings. And whatever those feelings are for you, that doesn't mean that you have to cry. But you just need to feel what's going on for you as the individual. And children need to have that space. And to honor that space, at Forget Me Not, we facilitate grieving. We don't do therapy, but we follow the child. We follow their lead. We don't teach them or interpret anything. We're simply there to hold a free and protected space. And we kind of think at Forget Me Not that if we can really take care of the parents, we can help them hold that space for their children, because parents want to. They just are hurting so much themselves that they don't quite know how.
I don't want to get away from the myths and misconceptions because I like
yeah.
it. However, you said you have to do the work, which gets us into therapy. What do you mean you have to do the work if to get through the grieving is what I heard you
well,
imply.
Well, by the work, where I see the work of grief is learning how do you go on living a healthy life even though you have this big hole in your heart. You have to figure out, how am I going to go on living without my important person? And that's what I believe is the work of grief. It's not therapy in terms right. of work of grief, but how do I get up in the morning? How do I get myself dressed? How do I learn to laugh and love, even though I know that someone else in my life might die? That's, children are often afraid if one of their parents have died, who else will die? Will I die? These big questions come up.
So how to get back to normal?
How to get back to a new normal.
A new normal, because it will never be
normal.
The same.
Okay. All right. Yeah. But not letting these emotions and these physical things run us.
And get stuck in us. Sometimes that we get stuck in not knowing, not having enough support to go forward to and know that that person can always be part of our life. We do a lot of memory work how are you like your parent that died? How are you different? What kind of ice cream did you both like? How do we keep – children want to remember their special person, and how do we keep that part of who they are as they go forward? Because they grieve developmentally. How a child understands the death at six – they will renegotiate and understand in a new way when they're 10 and 12, a new way when they're graduating from high school, when they're getting married, when they're having their own children. I think our grief is continuous, and I think that's a myth, that we get over it. that we forget and we don't. We go on. This person is always a part of our life. My first important person that died when I was young was when I was 5. And I remember. And you don't want to know how old I am.
and also trusting your body and trusting that what you're feeling isn't going to kill you and you're going to survive it and that there are people there that you can share it with. A lot of people, well, adolescents in particular, will put their grief off. In other words, I don't have time for this. I can't cry right now. I have to do my homework. I have to do the work of my life. And so it's pushed aside. Well, it's going to come back. Also, people might push it aside with substances. Mm-hmm. Also just doing busy work or exercise or whatever a human needs to do to get away from it. The substance part and the benzodiazepines, it's not going to help you.
We have another caller. Amy, you're on line one. Amy, are you still with us? We lost her.
Oh, darn.
Let me get my train of thought back. What should we talk about? We talked about the misconceptions.
Did we talk about magical thinking?
We haven't mentioned magical thinking.
I love magical thinking.
What does that have to do with grieving?
Well, all of us, I think, engage in it to a certain extent, mm-hmm. but children we see more of often think that they've caused the death somehow.
Ah.
And lots of guilt right. around how mm-hmm. They one of my stories that really made an impression on me was the child who thought she had killed her grandmother who was dying of cancer because her grandmother had asked her for a drink and she had brought her a soda. Mm-hmm. And she knew that sodas were bad for people.
Mm-hmm. I don't think of that as a magical thing. I see what you're saying, but I just think of all humans have to seem to have guilt. It's a big deal. With divorces, we talk about that with kids in the same way, that they need to make sure everyone realizes that they're not the reason for that divorce.
Right.
Huh.
Yeah, or if there's thunder at the time of death, for instance, then the magical thinking would be, okay, it's thundering outside and someone's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's associating it with – that's an association – not really magical.
Are there symptoms that we should mention or signs that are indicative that you're going to need more help, that we're sliding into some more significant components of this grieving process?
When we look at grief, we can't look at just how was it yesterday and make our comparison. We need to take a broader, a longer view. Are we feeling better than we did last week, last month? But we do, when children stop doing their normal developmental things that they need to be doing, that's one big sign that we need to that they need extra help. Poor concentration is a normal part of grief, but at a certain point, if it doesn't get better over weeks, then we want to see what can we do to help. Irritability and anger, we expect that. We expect to see grief bursts that are anger with children, but when the anger gets over the top, that's not normal or as normal, and we want to investigate. Obviously, using drugs and alcohol in children is something that we want to attend to right away.
Wanting to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because children know how to make themselves dead. So wanting to be dead, really need to look into that.
Okay.
There's a normal sadness of grief, but there can also be the helplessness and hopelessness feelings that are more suicidal, and people need help right away with that.
All right. Amy, we got you back on the line. What can we do for you?
Hi. You've already sort of touched on this, but I've got a question about young children, 4 or 5, who experience a loss, a major loss, and then you were talking about how the grief will manifest itself, or they'll have to return to that at different stages in life. And I was just wondering if you could speak specifically how it might manifest itself at different stages in life, and
how
people deal with this.
Yeah, how it may come up again, and in what way, what form. Okay. I'm going to put you off the line because we've only got a couple of minutes. We want to get this answered. Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Well, I think a child, say, that has a parent die at six, when they're graduating from grade school, parent isn't there. They understand that loss in a new way from an 12 or 13-year-old perspective in a much different way than they did with when they're six.
And the story changes, and they still need to – they begin by playing, then they start putting words to it, and being present and listening. So it's hard to say because it is an individual thing, mm-hmm. and then it looks different in adolescence than it looked in pre-adolescence or before that.
I thought Amy was kind of saying, well, what happens if you had somebody lost really early in life, but now you're 20? How might that come back?
It might come back with, you know, you don't have a mom when you're getting married or thinking about getting married. What is this love stuff? And how do I know when it's the right person? Mm-hmm. And you don't have a mom to talk to about that, or you don't have a dad to talk to about that.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get your first job. And, you know, there's some sort of issue, and your mom or your dad aren't there kind of to be. So you have a new missing, and in that you have new growth about understanding what is this relationship I've had, what is it I've missed.
And then you're also going to grow into that age where that person was when they died. So you're going to have ideas about death and dying and ideas about your own life that you may not be conscious of. So there'll be anxieties and just uneasy feelings will come up. I think anxiety and depression are things that people tend to feel when that date comes around. Your bodies remember it.
So I think the what helps is knowing that some of these reactions are normal and are part of grief many years later.
Okay. Well, thanks to Karen Moyer for taking her time, and Donna and Shirley Wilson, thanks very much for coming and spending the day with us. Line One will return next week. With my guests will be Drs. Rod Singleton, Neil Murphy, and Tom Hennessy of South Central Foundation and the Centers for Disease Control. We'll be discussing the benefits and risks of a new vaccine being promoted to prevent cervical cancer. Pat Yak is president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, your health connection, is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. And by the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with the wheelchair on the sign. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.